From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a frantic search for survivors of a sunken South Korean ferry. Operations continue to find the missing Malaysian airliner. Are the U.S. and Russia in a new Cold War?
People are reluctant to think that we could fall again into something as large, complicated, dangerous, with particularly the shadow of nuclear Armageddon.
Possible prospects for increased cooperation among Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Desperate efforts continue to save people still missing a day after a ferry carrying about 470 passengers sank off South Korea's southwestern coast. Most of the passengers were high school students and their teachers on an excursion. Zlatissa Hoke reports that a U.S. Navy ship stands ready to assist in the massive rescue operation.
Coast Guard, military vessels, helicopters, and divers have been searching for survivors of the sunken ferry. Distraught parents gathered along the coast, hoping for the return of their children and bracing for the worst. This mother of an 18-year-old student describes her shock at hearing that the ship has sunk.
I felt like my heart stopped. I can't describe the feeling with one word. I was too shocked. I can't even talk about it.
It was not immediately clear why the Seawall ferry listed heavily to one side and capsized in calm waters off South Korea's southwest coast. Some survivors reported hearing a loud noise before the vessel started sinking. Some of the passengers who jumped into the water as the ferry went down were picked up by commercial vessels. Rescue teams balanced on the sinking hull to pull some people from cabin windows, and helicopter crews plucked others from the deck. Survivors were taken to a temporary shelter where they were wrapped into blankets and received medical assistance.
I held a handrail and moved toward the right side of the ferry to ride a helicopter as water kept coming in.
Many others were not so lucky and remained trapped in the ship's cabins. This elderly woman says she followed the crew's instructions to stay in place.
I was keeping still without making any movements. There was an announcement that we should not move.
The Seawall sank Wednesday morning near the island of Jindo. Officials from the company that owns the ship apologized for the accident. During a meeting with emergency officials, South Korean President Park Geun-hye expressed her sympathies to those affected.
I think it is truly tragic that the students who were going on a field trip and the passengers were involved in such an unfortunate accident.
The U.S. Navy's amphibious assault ship, USS Bonhomme Richard, is nearby and has helicopters and boats to help if needed. The large ship was on routine patrol in waters west of the Korean Peninsula. Low water temperatures and fast currents worsened the situation overnight for any possible survivors. Zlatissa Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Navy spokesman Arlo Abrahamson spoke about the U.S. rescue effort with NBC Television's Savannah Guthrie.
First, I just would like to say that on behalf of the United States Navy, our thoughts are with the families of the Korean passenger ship Seawall during what we know is a very difficult and uncertain time.
It's an incredibly difficult time, sir, and I know there's the USS Bonhomme Richard that is in that area. To what extent is the U.S. Navy involved in search and rescue this morning?
That's correct. We do have the USS Bonhomme Richard, which is an amphibious assault ship that has about 3,000 embarked sailors and Marines. Now, that ship has the capabilities. They have a MB-22 Osprey aircraft as well as the MH-60 helicopters. And currently, we have two MH-60 search and rescue capable helicopters that are contributing to the search and rescue operations. And we remain in very close contact with the on-scene commander. And I also should point out that we have a very close relationship with the Republic of Korea Coast Guard and Navy. And we do rehearse these types of operations, and we'll continue to support as required by the Republic of Korea.
You refer to it as a search and rescue operation, and I think that's the question everyone's wondering this morning. Is there hope that there may still be survivors there?
Well, from the U.S. Navy perspective, as long as we're tasked to do search and rescue, which we are currently still doing, we still remain optimistic and we still hold out hope that there will be some survivors out there. So we'll continue to work tirelessly alongside our partners in the Republic of Korea Navy and Coast Guard until we're asked to stop searching. But currently, our people are out there assisting in this effort.
And I don't want to put you on the spot, but I have heard, given how quickly that ship turned over and sank, there's the possibility that there may be some air pockets. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, what I can tell you is, you know, every search and rescue operation is very unique and very difficult. And as you know, and have heard and have reported on, the area where this occurred is the area of high traffic, and the weather of today was not very good. So it is a very difficult area. But again, our forces are trained for search and rescue, and we'll continue to support the Republic of Korea Navy and Coast Guard as requested.
U.S. Navy spokesman Arlo Abrahamson appearing on the NBC Television's Today Show. A U.S. Navy's robotic submarine looking for the missing Malaysian passenger plane continues its seabed search for any signs of the plane, demanding face-to-face regular meetings with Malaysian government officials and answers to their questions about the search. Relatives of the 153 Chinese passengers who were on board walked out of a video conference with high-level Malaysian officials in Kuala Lumpur on Tuesday. They were angered by lack of evidence that the plane crashed in the southern Indian Ocean, as announced last month by the Malaysian Prime Minister.
You have absolutely no shame. You're all bloody liars and you're lying to us again now.
The relatives also are demanding to meet with representatives from companies involved in the search, such as Boeing, Rolls-Royce and Inmarsat. The spokesman for the relatives, Jiang Hui, urged the relatives to walk out of the meeting and later explained that the video conference meetings do not work well due to connectivity issues. He noted that the long-standing demands of the relatives of the passengers have not been met. Meantime, Malaysia's acting transport minister, Hishamuddin Hussein, told reporters the search for missing Flight 370 will not be lessened in any way.
I think as far as Malaysia is concerned, and I can only speak for Malaysia, we will not scale down. And this is a promise that I've made to the families of the passengers, and we will continue.
He also said that more countries might get involved in the next phase of the search.
So the 26 countries that started with us on this journey can be increased to a lot more as we move on to the next phase. But I will not announce it until there's more concrete development on that part.
Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 disappeared on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8th. There were 239 people aboard. Relations between the United States and Russia have hit a low point since Moscow annexed the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea. In this report from Washington, VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnera looks at whether the two sides are returning to a Cold War.
The Cold War lasted roughly from the end of World War II in 1945 to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Georgetown University professor Charles Kupchin says the Cold War was a rivalry between a Western bloc led by the United States and an Eastern bloc led by the Soviet Union.
It was defined by ideological competition, a communist system versus a capitalist system, an autocratic system versus a democratic system, and it was defined by traditional geopolitical rivalry for dominance both over the military-industrial heartland as well as over proxies in the developing world.
Since the demise of the Soviet Union, memories of the Cold War have faded. But there is talk now of a new Cold War following Russian President Vladimir Putin's annexation of Ukraine's peninsula, Crimea. During a speech in Brussels, President Barack Obama dismissed the notion of a new Cold War.
This is not another Cold War that we're entering into. After all, unlike the Soviet Union, Russia leads no bloc of nations, no global ideology.
President Obama also described Russia as a regional power that is threatening some of its immediate neighbors, not out of strength, but of weakness. Kupchin agrees, saying Russia is not what it used to be.
During the Cold War, Russia had millions of soldiers under arms. It had a world-class navy. It had proxy client states around the world. That is not the Russia that we have today. Russia today has 750,000, 800,000 men under arms. Its navy is a sad shadow of what it used to be. It has very few allies in the world. And it's for that reason, I think, that a return to the Cold War is not on. Russia doesn't really have what it takes.
But Columbia University Professor Emeritus Robert Legvold has a different view.
I believe we're already in a new Cold War. That's not a majority view. I think most people are reluctant to think that we could fall again into something as large, complicated, dangerous, with particularly the shadow of nuclear Armageddon as we had in that 50-year period earlier.
Legvold says some of the essential characteristics of the Soviet Union's relationship with the West during that period are true of the relationship between Russia and the West today.
Well, first of all, rather than the ambiguous sense of the other side that both the U.S. and Europe had of Russia for much of the last 20 years, that is sort of neither friend nor foe, something in between, but not quite clear what, reciprocated by the Russians, who thought of the West in much the same terms, that's disappeared. And you see each side now literally not only defining the other side as an adversary, but calling it such in the speeches that we've had from major leaders and pundits in the press.
Legvold says another sign of a new Cold War is that, in his view, officials in Washington and Moscow have apparently given up on the idea of working towards a fundamentally different cooperative relationship.
The assumptions that underlay the Obama administration's reset, for example, they've now disappeared, been replaced by the notion that the most we can hope for are momentary, quite specific, quite limited transactions that may be cooperative, but not something that adds up to a level of cooperation that begins to lead us toward genuine and durable partnership.
Many experts believe a genuine and durable partnership could only be achieved with new leaders in Washington and Moscow. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
With the political situation in Afghanistan in flux and international forces due to leave the country by the end of the year, the debate in neighboring Pakistan is focusing on prospects for increased cooperation among Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Iran. Sharon Bain reports from Islamabad.
In just 8 months, the last of the international forces are due to leave Afghanistan, ending a 13-year battle against the Taliban and other militants. Analysts warn if Kabul's neighbors do not start to cooperate, competing desires for influence could deteriorate into a bloody proxy war in the country. Pakistani senator and chairman of the Defense Committee, Mujahid Hussain Syed, recalls the last proxy war played out in Afghanistan between Pakistan and Iran, which destabilized the region in the 1990s.
Pakistan and Iran must avoid making the mistakes of the past. We tried to overreach. We had outsized ambitions. The time has changed. There are new realities. In Afghanistan, the elections have shown that there's a supremacy of the ballot over the bullet.
But because of the competing and overlapping interests of the four main regional players, Pakistan, Iran, India, and China, as well as the United States, it is unclear if a strong, coherent regional consensus will emerge anytime soon. Rifat Hussain, a professor of public policy at the National University of Sciences and Technology, is not optimistic.
That you are a contiguous state, you want to implement non-interference, non-intervention doctrines, but the developments inside Afghanistan, particularly the growing influence of your rival powers, does not allow you to exercise that option. So non-interference is not a viable option in my judgment.
But regional dynamics are changing. A lot will depend on the strategic decisions taken by the new political leadership in Iran, Pakistan, China, and after the ongoing elections in India and Afghanistan. There are questions as to what extent traditional rivals Pakistan and India and Iran and the United States will be able to overcome past animosities and mistrust. Islamabad is also seen by Kabul as siding with the Afghan Taliban in order to keep a hand in Afghanistan's political direction. But Sheri Rahman, Pakistan's former ambassador to Washington, says there is a strategic shift underway in Pakistan's policy towards Kabul, away from dominance and towards cooperation.
If we want to look at policy through a new lens, as opposed to the old ball and chain of strategic depth, then we will look at no favorites.
But in an example of persisting friction between Islamabad and Kabul, Afghanistan's cultural attaché to Islamabad, Zardasht Shams, questioned Rahman's position.
We have the legitimate elected Afghan government, and then we have insurgents. So there should be favorites. The Afghan government should be the favorite, not the... There should be no doubt who are the favorites.
Future peace will also depend heavily on the political acumen and political deal-making ability of Afghanistan's next president. Partial results from the April 5th elections point at two possible winners: former World Bank official Ashraf Ghani and former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Islamabad.
Saudi Arabia's intelligence chief, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, has been removed from his post at his own request, according to Saudi state media. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau.
حسم الأمر الملكي السعودي وما كان مجرد تسريبات صحفية حول إخراج بندر بن سلطان.
The news that Prince Bandar bin Sultan is being replaced as Saudi intelligence chief was cheered by his arch enemies, including Iran and its top allies, Syria and Lebanon's Hezbollah. Iran's Al Alam TV blamed the prince for supporting al-Qaeda in Syria and attributed his political demise to his failure to defeat Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The 65-year-old prince is being replaced by his deputy, General Yusuf al-Idrisi. Bandar had been spearheading Saudi efforts to unseat President Assad in the bitter and bloody Syrian civil war, supporting various Sunni rebel factions. But he came under criticism for supporting al-Qaeda, prompting King Abdullah to wrest Syria operations away from him in February, handing them to Interior Minister Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. American University of Beirut professor Hilal Kashan has written about Prince Bandar and tells VOA that supporting al-Qaeda is a sore spot in the kingdom.
There was a prelude to dismissing him. A few months ago, the Saudis announced that they would put on trial any Saudi fighting in Syria. And Bandar invested in supporting al-Qaeda in Syria. He wanted to get rid of the Syrian regime at any cost, even to the point of working with al-Qaeda. So the moment the Saudis decided to ban Saudis from going to Syria, it became clear that Bandar's approach to Syria has failed and that Saudis were about to alter their policy on Syria.
Kashan says it took Saudi Arabia 10 years to evict al-Qaeda from Saudi soil, so many Saudi princes were angry over Bandar's support for the group in Syria, which they feared would ultimately come back to haunt them. He says Bandar frequently clashed with other members of the royal family.
He fell from grace because obviously he failed in Syria. Since 2006, when he was appointed as the kingdom's intelligence boss, he disappeared from the scene four times, mainly because he kept clashing with members of the royal family. He's a difficult person, and I understand he is arrogant, and he was sent abroad on the pretext of seeking medical service.
Prince Bandar's relations with the United States have been rocky, and he has reportedly threatened on several occasions to effect a major shift away from the Saudi kingdom's long alliance with Washington. Bandar has reportedly criticized the Obama administration for not supplying Syrian rebels with heavy weaponry. The prince was a well-known figure in Washington, where he served as Saudi ambassador to the United States for nearly 30 years. He also had close ties to former presidents George W. Bush and his father, George H.W. Bush. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The man accused of a deadly shooting spree outside two Jewish community sites in the Midwestern U.S. state of Kansas has made his first court appearance. The suspect, 73-year-old Frazier Glenn Cross, was charged with murder. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. Cross is being held on $10 million bond. His next court appearance is scheduled for April 24th. Federal prosecutors say they're pursuing federal hate crime charges on Cross and will present evidence to a grand jury soon. That, too, could be a death penalty case. Cross is a Vietnam War veteran and longtime white supremacist and Ku Klux Klan member. Max Abrams, a professor at Northeastern University and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, believes the KKK should be defined as a terrorist organization.
When Americans think about terrorism, we tend to think about the same kinds of international terrorist groups that other people in the world, you know, might think of. Al-Qaeda and its offshoots, you know, Palestinian groups, and maybe in the 1970s that, you know, very publicly blew up commercial airplanes, the IRA, etc. But it's interesting that Americans don't tend to think about their own domestic terrorism problem. We have, for a long time, hate groups in the United States that, you know, basically are indistinguishable from terrorist groups in the sense that they're non-state actors, which means, you know, we're not talking about the government. We're talking about, you know, a lone wolf or a small cell or an organization. They use violence against civilian targets in order to terrorize a broader population for some kind of a political or ideological goal. And in particular, it's interesting that Americans, you know, always look abroad for the terrorism problem rather than at home. It's interesting, given the fact that, you know, the United States, since the 1860s, has had to contend with the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK. And this organization has killed thousands of African Americans in particular, although as well as other minority groups. The KKK is also rabidly anti-Semitic. And so that seems to be the motive of the Kansas City attacker. He had strong ties to the KKK. He, you know, on the eve of Passover, attacked two Jewish sites, the Jewish Community Center outside of Kansas City, as well as down the street, another Jewish facility was a retirement home. And while he did it, he was yelling, "Hail Hitler." But it's very interesting because there was copious media attention to this attack. And yet the media were very reluctant to label it as a terrorist attack, even though that's really what it was.
Do you think that the U.S. government should change laws or the police should change their approach to these groups like the KKK?
I think that they really should. It's very hard to distinguish a hate crime from terrorism because in a hate crime, the perpetrator is targeting people on the basis of, you know, of their religion, of their ethnicity, of their sexual preference. So essentially, there's some kind of an ideological component. A hate crime tends to be punished more than a so-called normal crime, because there are really multiple victims. There's the immediate victim of the crime. In this case, you know, the three people who were killed outside of the Jewish facilities. But what makes it a hate crime is that it's sort of doubly punitive because it spreads fear to another group, which also gets victimized, the broader American Jewry. And terrorism is very, very similar because you have the immediate victims and then you have the general population, which is also terrified. And so I find it very hard to distinguish a hate crime from terrorism. And I think that the word terrorism really carries sort of an extra punch. And so I would certainly be in favor of labeling attacks like which would happen outside of Kansas City as terrorism.
Max Abrams, a professor at Northeastern University in Boston and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On April 17, 1492, Christopher Columbus signed a contract with Spain to find a new route to Asia. In 1895, the Treaty of Shimonoseki between China and Japan was signed. It marked the end of the First Sino-Japanese War. The war ended in a stunning victory for Japan. China was forced to renounce its claims to Korea and Taiwan, as well as other territory. On this day in 1961, the CIA began an ill-fated invasion of Cuba in a failed operation to overthrow the communist government of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. The Bay of Pigs invasion ended up as an embarrassment to the new U.S. president at the time, John F. Kennedy. In 1969, the architect of Czechoslovakia's Prague Spring, Alexander Dubček, was forced to resign. The Soviet Union feared Dubček's program of liberal reforms in its satellite state could weaken the communist bloc. The imposition of an authoritarian leadership brought Czechoslovakia back in line with Soviet policies. In 1970, the crippled Apollo 13 spacecraft made it back to Earth safely despite damage done mid-flight by an exploding oxygen tank. On this day in 1971, leaders of what would become the People's Republic of Bangladesh formed a government in exile in India. Later that year, after a bloody war, Bangladesh gained recognition of its independence from Pakistan. In 1975, soldiers of Cambodia's Khmer Rouge marched unopposed into the capital, Phnom Penh, ending 5 years of civil war. Residents of the city celebrated, but within hours, the joy would turn to horror as the hardline Khmer Rouge began to implement a murderous plan to build a utopian communist society. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Health officials in West Africa are struggling to contain an outbreak of Ebola hemorrhagic fever, a deadly contagion that has claimed more than 100 lives. The first cases were reported last month in Guinea, and now also are being seen in neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone. While working to respond to the crisis, the World Health Organization has not recommended any trade or travel restrictions in the region. Nevertheless, as a sign of its concern, Senegal has closed the land border it shares with Guinea as a preventive measure. Given the deadly nature of the disease, such concern is justified. Ebola is highly infectious and has no cure. A particularly virulent virus, Ebola is believed to originate in an infected animal and is spread to humans by diet or contact with bodily fluids. Its early symptoms include fever and weakness, then deepens with bouts of diarrhea, vomiting, and internal bleeding. There have been previous outbreaks of the disease in the forests of Central Africa, but this is the first incidence of it reported in the West African nations now contending with it. They are not acting alone, though. The United States and other partners are working with international health officials to aid the fight. A five-member team from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Viral Special Pathogens Branch flew to Guinea on March 31st to provide expert advice and consultation. In addition, a small team of CDC experts will travel to Liberia to provide technical assistance to the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare. The U.S. Agency for International Development is funding a mobile laboratory in Guinea that can quickly do tests in suspected cases of the disease. Under another USAID grant, protective equipment is being provided to healthcare workers treating the sick. The U.S. Defense Department is working with Metabioba, Inc., a company that monitors viral disease threats around the world, to provide assistance for lab testing of samples from suspect cases. Our diplomatic missions in the capitals of the affected nations, as well as others, are monitoring the situation there closely. And USAID has provided $583,500 through UNICEF's Regional Rapid Response Fund to provide households and clinics in Guinea with supplies and equipment, as well as fund a public information campaign to help people protect themselves from infection. Finally, we extend our sympathies to the families and loved ones of those who have died. And for those fighting the disease, know that our hearts and prayers are with you.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.